Good evening, everyone. I want to thank you for tuning in to Moms Fighting Autism. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernatitis. I have three children, 19, 18, and 13. My 13-year-old was diagnosed with autism when he was 4. And since then, I've been very active in the autism community. I've served as president of the Dayton chapter of the Autism Society of America, and I've worked as the assistive technology specialist for Goodwill Easter Seals. Currently, I work as a one-on-one aide for a young lady with autism in her school. Just some housekeeping issues: to listen and submit questions to tonight's webinar, you can log in to www.momsfightingautism.com, and there you'll see a blue box in the upper left-hand corner of the screen. It's there that you can click Listen In, and you can hear the discussion via the Internet. You can click Slides and view the slideshow when it begins. And you can click Ask a Question and submit your questions via the Internet. We try to get to as many of the questions similar topics as we can in the time that we have allotted. You can also listen in by phone by calling 949-333-4806. Again, that's 949-333-4806. And enter conference ID number 168978, 168978 pound. All callers are muted, so don't worry about background noises. We can't hear you. Later, I'll let you know how you can raise your hand to ask a question live with our presenter if you choose to. We have allotted 2 hours for tonight's webinar, so let's go ahead and get started. This evening, our webinar is about sensory processing disorder, and it is entitled, The Out-of-Sync Child, How Sensory Processing Disorder Affects Kids with Autism Spectrum Disorder. It is presented by Carol Kranowitz. Carol was a preschool teacher for 25 years, and she observed many young children with SPD, or sensory processing disorder. Today, she teaches parents, educators, and other professionals how sensory issues play out, and she suggests activities for addressing them at home and at school. Her books and DVDs include The Out-of-Sync Child and The Out-of-Sync Child Has Fun. Those are two of my favorite books. Mm-hmm. Sensory Issues in Learning and Behavior Video, a children's book entitled The Good Enoughs Get in Sync, and a preschool sensory scan for educators. It's shortened to Preschool Sense, S-E-N-S-E. It's a screening tool for therapists working with teachers. Carol is a board member of the SPD Foundations and editor-in-chief of SI Focus, the magazine devoted to sensory processing issues. I want to remind you that Carol is not a therapist. She does have extensive knowledge about young children, and she can't answer specific questions about specific children, but we will just try to hit the major topic. You know, if you've submitted a question about a specific child, we'll try to hit the major topic. Welcome, Carol.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Nancy. And thank you, everybody who's listening all over the country. It's 9 o'clock. I live in Maryland, and it's wet and cold and slushy out there, but I'm not alone. I know across the country everyone's feeling the same way. If you have the slides, let's proceed. I'm going to give you the spiel that gives the basics of sensory processing disorder and hope to tie it in so that you as parents of children with autism will begin to understand better what is underlying the child's behavior. Sensory processing. I'm just getting used to this slideshow. The sensory processing is the interpretation and the organization of sensations in the central nervous system. And, for instance, we take in sensations all the time at every given moment. Right now you're using your eyes to take in visual information and your ears for oral information, and your skin is telling you what your clothes feel like, and if your body position sense tells you whether you're sitting or standing or hanging from your ankles or whatever you're doing. So we take in lots and lots of sensory information at every given second of the day that come into our central nervous system, which interprets these and tells us what to do about it. So if you are uncomfortable with the light too bright, you do something about it. You turn it off. Or you close the door if there's too much noise behind you. We are conscious of many of our sensations, and we have the ability to do something about it. When we're talking about sensory processing, it's not just the five senses that we're all familiar with, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. These, of course, are very important. But the basic senses that start while the baby is still in utero are the touch system, the vestibular system, and the proprioceptive system. And the senses of seeing and hearing that our American schools teach to develop over time. The baby doesn't come out with those well-equipped. He needs a lot of sensory motor experiences to fine-tune seeing and hearing so that he's ready for school. And those will develop over time if some earlier senses have a strong foundation. And that's what we're all about. We can't skip the development of these early sensations. I'll explain. The touch sensation, if you look at this picture of the little boy, there's a dotted line that goes all the way around his body. That's to tell you that we have touch receptors all over our body. And some of these receptors are very sensitive in the face, in the hands and fingertips, in the, the palms of the hands, for instance, in the genitals, in our hair follicles. We're very, very sensitive. And then we have receptors in other parts of our body that are less receptive, for instance, the shoulder or the elbow. So, you know, when you want to get a child's attention, you don't come up and stick your hand in his face. You might put a firm hand on his shoulders, and that will not alert him in a negative way. The touch sense develops very young. The baby is already learning about touch as he is developing in utero. And it becomes, it is the primary sense for little tiny babies and is really the basis for first relationships. So the baby who enjoys being cuddled and held and doesn't mind having a bath or getting changed, is at an advantage over the child who has very sensitive skin receptors and will resist and arch and cry when fondled and caressed. And that can be very difficult for parents, of course, who are trying to love their baby, and he doesn't seem to love them. But it's not about the parents. It's about the processing of those tactile sensations. Here's another picture of this little kid. He has here the vestibular sense and the proprioceptive sense, and you'll also see interoception, which is about internal organs. I'm more interested in the vestibular and the proprioceptive senses. The vestibular sense, like the touch or tactile sense, develops in utero, so the baby's learning what when he's upside down and sideways and he learns this because in the inner ear, there's a tiny little apparatus, the semicircular canals and other pieces of equipment in there that I won't go into right now. And they tell whenever our head is tilted, and it tells us when our head is changing its position in relation to the surface of the earth. So the baby comes out, and the baby seems to know that he is upright or he's lying down. He can tell when he's falling and will grab onto something. And this is good. Nature needs us to know this from the get-go, where we are in space, so that we can move confidently and feel connected to the earth and get into different positions and get out of those positions. The vestibular sense is considered the master sense. It tells us, it's so important that we know where we are, where our head is in space, that it's it would cause primal terror in people who don't have a good vestibular sense. An example would be if someone said, okay, here's a pair of skis. Now, I know you've never been on skis before, and here's this nice mountain called Mount Everest, and here we are at the top. Have a good ski down the mountainside. So if you're not going to do that, you're going to sit down at the top of Mount Everest and wait for someone to come help you. You're not going to go skiing down because your vestibular system couldn't possibly handle it. We see people frequently having some difficulty with their vestibular system, and I'll get to that. Proprioception is another sense that develops in utero, and this is the unconscious awareness of one's muscles and joints. So as the baby is flexing and stretching his tiny little arms and legs and moving his head around, he is practicing getting information into his muscles and joints, which is pretty important. Helps him get born. So anyway, we need these basic senses, the touch, the vestibular, and the proprioceptive sense, to be in good working order when we're born, and those are the foundation for the all learning that comes ahead. We need sensory processing for just about everything we do. We need it for our bodies, so we have stamina, we're strong, we can move, we can direct our movements, we can respond to what's happening around us. We need sensory processing for developing our thoughts, for making associations, for retrieving words and making and remembering memories. The more we use our body, the better our mind becomes, because as we're walking through space or relating to other people or going through an obstacle course or whatever we're doing as little kids, very busily moving around, we are learning all about our relationship to the world and how we can affect it. And that's what we want. We don't want kids always to be done to. We want them to be the ones who are doing. I think of it as we want kids to be doers, not doees. And good sensory processing helps children with their ability to do that thinking and creative work. We need sensory processing for our emotional well-being, too, because when our bodies are working well and when we're self-regulated in our movements and our sleep and our self-consoling and our stop and go, then we are feeling a lot better about ourselves than we would if we didn't have good sensory processing. If we were always concerned about a body that was uncooperative, it would make us feel not very good about ourselves. The end result of sensory processing is praxis. This is a Greek word. It means doing or action. And this is what we want. We want to be able to do. Praxis has three steps. One is ideation. That means coming up with an idea. And an example would be putting on a seatbelt in a car that you've not driven in before. The next step in praxis is motor planning. Okay, we want to put on a seatbelt. That's a good idea. How are we going to plan our movements so that we can do that? And the third step is execution, actually going through the motor plan. So research is showing that children who have sensory processing problems, and that would probably be everybody with autism, people with these difficulties do not do such a hot job of ideation. They might look at a situation and not know what they're supposed to do. And certainly you know children who you take to the playground and they look at the swing and they really need a lot of guidance to get their bodies over to the swing and situated on it. They don't have the idea of how to get on it. And then that causes problems with the motor planning and, of course, with the execution. So what we want to do is get kids so that they are praxic. Here's a picture of a little boy who has great praxis. He's the kind of kid who says, okay, I'm going to try something different. And he came up with this idea to cram his feet into two sand buckets and his hands into two orange traffic cones, and he's clapping the cones together and shuffling across the gritty, noisy blacktop around the sandbox. And he's having a wonderful, noisy time. He's making up his own rhythmic patterns with the clapping, and he's laughing in this photograph. And this is what I love to see. I love a kid who picks up something and looks at it in a new way and tries to do something different. And as parents, we need to be, and teachers, we need to be mindful of this, because often children are going to pick something up and do something different with it that isn't in the directions. But hey, why not? I prefer having items around for children to play with that have no guidelines or directions, and I like to see what they can do. This is what we want them to do, come up with some novel ideas themselves. Sensory processing, everybody does it. Everybody needs it, and most people use it efficiently. But then there are some, and you're here to learn more about it. Some kids are having difficulty processing their sensations, and then their behavior and their learning are affected. So let's put on our sensory goggles. This is a term that my dear friend Lori Renke came up with. Lori's an SI mom who lives in New Hampshire. And she says that let's just put on our goggles and look at kids' underlying motivation, and it will explain so much about why they're grabbing onto your knee and tugging really hard. They're not trying to make you fall down, and they're not trying to make you angry. What they're trying to do, in many cases, is just get some deep pressure. And crashing into sturdy things and holding on tight or trying to press against them is something that a lot of children with sensory issues do. They're seeking pressure and resistance. And we think they're being naughty or they're certainly being annoying. And if we can understand what the reason is, it helps a lot. Okay, with our goggles on then, we can think about sensory processing disorder. And here's one definition, which is that this is the atypical reactions in the central nervous system to ordinary sensory experiences. So the reaction is happening in the central nervous system. There's nothing wrong with the receptors in the body. There's nothing diseased or damaged. The child gets the same sensory messages that everybody gets, but the processing plant in the central nervous system is not operating smoothly. Therefore, the responses of the child are going to be irregular. And when we look at behavior, we can say behavior means something. The biggies, when we're talking about sensory processing disorder, are touching and being touched, moving and being moved. And when we look at our kids' behavior and think, that's sort of unusual, he's not moving much or she's moving way too much, we can begin to think, maybe this is all about sensory processing. Possible causes. Tons of research is going on right now. In fact, sensory processing disorder is the most heavily researched area in the field of occupational therapy. And sometimes you'll hear people say, oh, I don't know much about sensory processing. There isn't much research. Well, those people haven't looked, because there's tons of it, and it's very exciting. At the moment, the specific genes have not been determined that are the underlying cause of SPD, but there's so much fast research going on with MRIs and fantastic research, and I expect someday we will know what those genes are. But right now we can say that SPD is familial. It runs in the family many times, and when it runs in the family, there is probably some genetic reason for it. If it's not running in the family, then the reasons would be environmental, and that would mean that it's not because of the family the child came from, but it's because maybe he had a rough birth, or maybe he was put into an orphanage or an institution that which was overcrowded and where he didn't get the kind of stimulation and affection and one-on-one connections that most babies need to thrive. It could be that that the baby has a sensitive nervous system, and so many things bother the baby. Toxins that wouldn't notice, that other people might not notice, might affect a child and might compromise the development of his neurological system. And I have heard that kids with SPD, like kids with autism, are like canaries in the coal mine, in the coal shaft, that when we look at them being irritable, we might realize, well, there might be something in this air or in this food that would make a lot of people irritable. So we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go. All right. Here we have the taxonomy or the classification of SPD. And according to Lucy Jane Miller, who is the primary investigator in the world of SPD, Lucy Miller and some of her colleagues came up with this classification, which divides SPD into three major categories. One is sensory modulation disorder, one is sensory discrimination disorder, and one is sensory-based motor disorder. So we'll talk about sensory modulation disorder. This is the most common, and the most common subtype of this category is sensory over-responsivity. I call this child the sensory avoider. She's fearful and cautious. She's pulling away from activities that other children seem to like, or she may be very negative and defiant and say things like, I'm not going to do that, you can't make me, I'm the boss of my body. So those are two different ways that over-responsivity often plays out. Fearful and cautious, or negative and defiant. What happens with this child, or adult, because adults have SPD too, what happens is, a door slams, and the child jumps out of his seat, and he looks around, and the other kids might notice that the door has slammed too. They might look up for a moment and then go back to their books on their desk, but this child might be out of his seat and very, very uncomfortable and anxious, and it might take a long, long time to settle down. So there's often this fight or flight response. Sometimes children can also freeze when there is some sensory input that they cannot interpret. So, you know, Mother Nature is smart. Mother Nature says, okay, person, if you can't interpret what's happening around you, the best thing is to react in a self-protective way. So protect yourself, and then you can figure it out when you've calmed down. And most of us can do this in an instant, but not when people have over-responsivity. It takes a long time to get over that door slamming. This is also called defensiveness. So you might hear the term tactile defensiveness, or auditory defensiveness. Those two are very common. And they often go together, in fact. Auditory and touch over-responsivity often go together. What can we do for kids who have SOR? One example is called the Wilbarger Deep Pressure and Proprioceptive Technique. And that little item there in the aqua box is a brush. I found that pretty picture on the web. It's a brush like that. It fits in your hand, and what you do with it is you, with the aid of an occupational therapist who teaches parents and teachers how to do this, you brush the child's arms and legs and hands and feet if he wants that. You don't brush the chest or sensitive or face or sensitive areas. But you brush really firmly, and that deep pressure is very calming for the over-responsive child. For some of you who are new to sensory processing disorder, it might seem strange that the same technique is also very organizing for children who are under-responsive. It is calming and organizing. So that's one thing that you can do with the help of an OT. Okay, I will just say, I'm going back to over-responsivity for a moment, because one thing that we all should be aware of is that all of us are over-responsive or under-responsive from time to time. If you can imagine what it's like after a very, very difficult day at work, and then you go to your car, and you have a flat tire, and then you finally get home, and you were looking forward to leftover casserole, and someone's eaten it all, and one thing after another goes wrong, and then everything seems to go wrong, and you get oversensitive, and you just don't want to deal. When we're sick, when we're very, very tired, when we're having hot flashes, a lot of situations can arise when we're feeling over-responsive. And what happens to over-responsive people when they get older? If their over-responsivity is not recognized and addressed, people with this tend to feel isolated, alone. No one understands them. They don't understand themselves why they don't want to participate in life. And as they get older, many people can learn to manage their oversensitivity. They learn that to wear very, very soft, comfortable clothes. They learn not to go out into bright sunlight. They learn not to go to crowded situations. Some of them grow up to be extremely important thinkers and wonderful contributors to the world, but it's best done in a quiet space, maybe in front of a computer or in a quiet office somewhere, because with over-responsivity, with so many sensations pouring in over their neurological threshold, they can't cope with it, so they just want to get away. Okay, sensory modulation disorder has two other subtypes. One is under-responsivity, and this is the person who you need a bomb dropped on the person's head to make him wake up. This child will seem very pleasant, and you might say about him, oh, he's not going to set the world on fire. And you might say he's got kind of a blah personality. And that's not true. Many times, under-responsive children are brilliant and dazzling and have so much to offer, but they just need a lot of intense input to get them started. With a child that I taught at nursery school, we found that we needed to help this. Oh, and he had autism. His mom would pull up to the school in the carpool line, and he would not make a move. And meanwhile, other children were starting to wriggle out of their car seats, and he would just sit there. So we decided not to wait for him to do that. We decided that we would help him out of the seatbelt, although we're always encouraging self-help skills. But the more important thing was to get that little boy out of the car on the sidewalk and into our arms. And so whoever was opening car doors would say, oh, we're so glad to see you. Oh, we need you so much. Thank you for coming to school today. And then we'd hug him and hug him, and sometimes he would like us to hug him upside down, and sometimes he would like us to sway forward and back while he was upside down. He loved that intense input. Then there was a garden that his teacher started, and he loved pushing the wheelbarrow and carrying the big bags of mulch, and he loved digging, and he was fantastic. He just loved all the heavy work activity we could give him. And then what we learned was, so did the other kids. So what we were doing for him, we were doing for all the other children, most of whom were typically developing. Okay. Another kind of... here's a picture of Edward Goodenough. He's the little boy in the Goodenough family in the children's book that I wrote, The Goodenough Skin and Sink. And this slide doesn't look like it came out too well. But what to do about under-responsivity? Well, one thing is what I call an accordion squeeze. That's where you sit behind the child. And this is a little kid, of course. You wouldn't do this with a 14-year-old. But to sit behind the child, hook your feet under the soles of the child's feet, and your legs surround his legs. And then you pull his feet in. Your feet will come in too, and you pull his feet in and squeeze him so his knees are up under his chin. And then you relax your legs, and his legs will extend. And then you squeeze his knees in and out, and in and out. And meanwhile, give him a lateral squeeze, so you're squeezing his ribs too from the sides. It's great. Kids love it. Heavy loads, that's things like boxes of books to carry, or here's if you can see this picture, it's a root beer bottle. You can pour the root beer down the drain because no one needs all that sugar, and instead fill the bottle two-thirds full with water. You can put some food coloring in it. Food coloring should not go into food for these kids, but it sure can go into these bottles that we call bottle babies. And give the kid 5 or 6 bottle babies, and you'd be amazed at the things that children will come up with to do. And this is for their sensory input. It's wonderful. Okay, there's another kind of subtype. It's called sensory seeking or sensory craving. And this is the child who notices sensations. So he's not like the under-responsive child who just doesn't notice them. The sensory seeker likes a lot of sensation, unlike the first example of the child who is frightened or uncomfortable by many sensations. And this one wants them more, more, more. He's almost like a sensory addict. He's got to have it. These kids will be your bumpers and crashers. They are your climbers. Everything's a climb, a ladder. The bookshelf is a ladder. The car is a ladder. I'm climbing up on the hood. They've just got to go, go, go. They never seem to be filled up, and in their impulsive behavior, they seem devilish and like they're seeking trouble all the time. And when we put on our sensory goggles and we look at kids who are seeking input all the time, it may become a bit clearer that the child is trying to get some input. So what do we do for that child? Well, heavy work activity and deep pressure, like that accordion squeeze, that would be good for kids who are sensory seekers. Other things, if we see these children spinning a lot, as many children with autism do, one idea is to stop the direction. So say they're on a tire swing, or say they're just standing and spinning. What you do is stop them abruptly and either turn them so they're going in the other direction, or you can also invert the child's head and point, you know, so if the child's upright while he's spinning, you can bend him over so his head is down. And sometimes that has a good effect, too. And a therapist usually has good ideas for what to do with that. Here are some kids who are seekers. The one on the left, Mud Monster Patrick, is a I think he's a typically developing child. His mother sent me this picture, but I included it here for you just because I wanted you to see how some kids just love wallowing in the mud. This mom had finally figured it out. He needed it. She wasn't going to try to deprive him of it. So she gave him the hose, and on warm summer days, she let him make a big mud puddle at the base of the slide, and he'd come down the slide and land in the puddle, and then behind him you can see there's a blue tub, a swimming pool, and he would get in there and kind of wash off. The picture of the child on the right, I love that too. This is a child with autism. He has limited language, but he says to his mom, "Noah Squishy," and that means, "Mommy, please put the tub out," and this is in the kitchen. And she puts some warm water into it and gives him some crazy foam, and so he's having a slightly cleaner time of it than Patrick. But these are both seekers. Now, their behavior looks like they're just out to make life miserable for everybody. When they're finger painting, and they're not just sticking to the paper, but they're finger painting the table and their neighbors and their own bodies from head to toe. So what we can do, one thing is, when the kids are little, shaving cream is pretty good. Get the unscented kind, and they'll come up cleaner than they started. Play-Doh is good, and if you don't approve of having children play with their food, then don't have them play with their food, but you can always welcome children into the kitchen to do things like mix cookie dough with their hands and meatloaf. And you can find, or another neat thing to do is fill the sink with a little bit of fuzzy water and give children old-fashioned egg beaters. And if they can manipulate that egg beater, they can get quite a nice froth going. And they're busy, they're active, and it's they're learning, and they're where the action is, and you can tell them all the time how much you need them. And everybody needs that. Everyone needs to be needed. So here are some strategies for the sensory-seeking child, and that would be interrupt the activity, reverse the direction, give the child some heavy work to do, change head position, or moving from spinning to pushing, or from pushing to spinning. And an OT who has some experience with sensory integration techniques would be able to come up with some more ideas here. Okay, let's go to the second category. Sensory modulation disorder is the first big category of SPD. Sensory discrimination disorder is another category. I call this child the sensory jumbler, and this is the one who has difficulty differentiating among and between stimuli. So that means you say, look at this picture, and you have a, say you have a picture that you're showing the child, and the child says, "Where's the picture?" And he hears the word pitcher, like you'd put water into, and can't make the connection between the picture in front of him and the word he heard in his ear. One day I was playing a recorder for a group of children, and I said, "This is a recorder, and some people call this a song flute." And a little boy in the class said, "Oh, Mrs. Granowitz, I had Fruit Loops for breakfast." So, you know, if I didn't know about auditory discrimination problems, I would have thought, what's he talking about? Why is he always off track? But fortunately, I did have some understanding, and I knew that he had heard song flute and thought, I said fruit, and so he thought we were having a conversation about fruit. Needless to say, this little boy, who was very cheerful and sunny and friendly and loved being at school, he had a lot of difficulty with conversations with the other children. They would be talking about, a cat, and he might think they said bat or something, and he would not be in on the conversation at all, and his attempts to make conversation would be unappreciated because he was talking about something different. Sensory jumblers, let's see, they have trouble getting the right button into the right buttonhole. So they often look like they're kind of slovenly, like they're not put together very well because they don't have good tactile and proprioceptive skills in their fingers, for instance, or their eyes aren't seeing what has to be seen, so that they can dress properly. They might go to pick up a bucket of water that they've picked up many times before, but each time is the first time. So they pick it up and the water goes all over the place, because they're not making all those sensory those associations of how heavy a bucket of water would be based on other buckets of water that the child has picked up. So auditory and visual discrimination are often part and parcel of SPD. Now, you can have visual or auditory problems, and we would not say that it's SPD because SPD has to have touch and or movement problems to be SPD. So in other words, you can have SPD and have visual and auditory discrimination problems, but if you have auditory or visual discrimination problems, that does not necessarily mean you have SPD. What do we do with these kids? Well, my best suggestion is allow more time. In a classroom, a teacher might say, what's the capital of Connecticut? And Billy might know that it's Hartford, but it takes him a little bit longer to process what the teacher has asked and then to get his mouth around the word and to get it out. Teacher doesn't have 10 seconds to wait. She might turn to somebody else who's got her hand in the air. So what we need to do is, if at all possible, give children more time so that they will feel successful, so that they'll know that they are being heard and that their knowledge is being acknowledged. Here's a picture of this is not a song flute in my mouth here. This is called a slide whistle. And I was playing a game with them where I make the slide whistle go, ooh, ooh, ooh. And their hands start on their knees and they go up and down and up and down with the sound of the slide whistle. So I'm hoping to help the children strengthen visual and auditory discrimination. Now, most of these kids get it. The little boy with a cap on has autism. He understands the game and he's enjoying it, but he is late, and that's fine. I go slowly so he can be at the top. He can finally get to the top when all the other kids are at the top and bring his hands down when they bring their hands down too. By the way, notice he's wearing a cap here. And at that nursery school, it was okay. We figured out that he liked that cap because it helped occlude a lot of visual distraction from him. And so that was something that he came up with himself. When that cap came down over his eyebrows, it was saying, there's too much commotion all around me, and this is helping me focus. The child that I'm really interested in this picture is the little one who's facing the camera with a faraway look in his eyes, and he's clinging to the sides of the tea stool. The tea stool has just one leg. It's a wonderful thing for kids to sit on because it requires them to find their center and sit up straight. And he's not finding his son very well. This little boy, it turns out, had a vestibular difficulty, which got in the way of knowing where his balance was and what was up and what was down. He, for instance, could not go up one step without, like, for instance, from the sidewalk into the school, without hanging on to a person or to the door. He was not very good at obstacle courses. He would cling to them. He'd go very slowly. And what we noticed was that his discrimination was affected in his vision and in his proprioception and in his vestibular senses. So he wasn't getting that feedback that was important for him to know where his body was and where to put his body parts. So what was the answer for him? Well, it was sitting on more T-stools, because it took him forever to get situated on that T-stool. More T-stools would be good for him, more obstacle courses, more of the very activities that he did not excel at. And, you know, so often we think, oh, he's no good at the playground, I won't take him to the playground. But if there's a way we could inch the children to the playground and bring them gently and in little bits to the table so that they get to participate in ways that make it comfortable for them, then we're doing these children a great favor. But I think lots of times we think, well, we're not doing kids a favor. Well, this is torture for this child. We're going to take him away from it. But I like to think, well, we don't want to torture the child, but we can't excuse the child from life. You know, everybody's got to get out the door every now and then. Most people do have to go to a birthday party now and then. And so what you can do is you can go take the child just for 5 minutes, just to hand over the present, wish the birthday person a happy birthday, and then make an exit. But a lot of times, because things are hard, we do a lot of protecting. Another kind of category is sensory-based motor disorder. Oh, and you know, no, sorry. I'm remembering all the stories I want to tell you, but I will tell you some stories. All right, sensory-based motor disorder. This has two subtypes too. One is called postural disorder, and I think of this kid as a sensory slumper. This child just can't sit up straight. He's always leaning or folding over. This is the child who often will sit on the floor in the W position with his knees together and his ankles splayed out to the sides, so that his legs look like a W rather than like an X. And this W position is really very bad for the child's skeletal development. It's bad for his knees and his hips. Now, why does a child do that? Well, it's to give himself a wider base, because being with his legs folded in front of him, he might tip over. But if his legs are out to the side, he's not going to tip over so much. So we have to get kids out of this position as much as possible. And a good way to help that child is to give him a seat that has a little back to it. You might know the canvas camp stool seats that fold, or sometimes TV chairs that don't take up a lot of space when they're not being used, but they give a back support to a child. That might help. Excuse me. There's a beautiful chair made in Maine. It's called a Howda Hug, H-O-W-D-A-H-U-G, Howda Hug. You can go to howdahug.com. And this is made out of slats of wood that conform to the child's shape. So it's like a hug. Oh, and it's wonderful. Children just love it. or a beanbag chair, or even putting a sensory slumper on a tea stool that we just saw in that photograph. You might think, well, that's the last place I would think of putting a kid like this. But in fact, it's very useful. It's very helpful. The child might do very well on it. This is a child who's all over the place, though. He's slipping and sliding. And I knew a boy who was 17 years old. He had not been diagnosed until he was 17. And in fact, the reason he was diagnosed at all with SPD was that his five-year-old brother was a student at the school I taught at, St. Columba's Nursery School in Washington, D.C., where we were screening kids for SPD. So the little brother was screened and found to have vestibular problems, and the mother said, oh, well, I think that describes my older son, too. And then she told us the story that he was always falling out of his chair at the dining room table or at the desk in his room, and they thought he was being goofy, and they scolded him. Anyway, one day, while he was at school, Mom went into his bedroom, and she saw that he had put little blobs of glue on the side edges of his desk chair, and in these little blobs of glue, he had stuck thumbtacks, pointy side up. So when he came home from school, she said, I saw all those sharp thumbtacks pointing up on your chair. What was going on? And he said, oh, Mom, I figured out that was a way to help me remember not to fall out of the chair. So here's a child, 17 years old, who was finally recognized as having tactile vestibular and proprioceptive problems. He didn't get that input that he was falling out of his chair, and it evolved in him into this postural disorder. Kids with postural disorder will often fatigue very easily. They'll say, oh, it's too far to go to the mailbox, or they certainly don't want to do any sports. They also might have a tendency to sprawl. So little kids will be on the rug, sprawled out. Their whole bodies might be out, splashed out on the rug when everyone else is sitting up at circle time. Overflow is another problem that goes along with postural disorder, and that is using body parts that are not needed for the task. And a typical example of that is when the child is trying to write or do a fine motor skill, and he has his tongue hanging out of his mouth. And we all use our mouths a lot when we're trying to concentrate. We might bite our lip or bite a fingernail or want a piece of gum or rub our lips or something. When we do something with our mouths, that's an organizing technique we have. The mouth is a big organizer. So anyway, a child might stick his tongue out while he's trying to put two pieces of Lego together, and you'll see that. Now, we all do some overflow, so don't get excited. But it's when, it's more than that. It's when oh, here's something you can do, even though you can't see me to demonstrate it. I want you, wherever you are now, I want you to hunch your shoulders up really high so your shoulders are nearly touching your ears, and squeeze your elbows into your ribs. And if you're sitting, squeeze your legs and your knees and your ankles together. I want you to be really tight all over. Okay, now pick up a pencil and start to write a few letters with your pencil. And I want everything really, really tight. Now, if you've done that, it'll be hard to write. But that's how a lot of kids with postural disorder do visual motor tasks. They will they'll recruit their shoulders, their tongues, their whole bodies get involved. They get very, very tight all over using more body parts that are necessary. And the reason is that they don't have the underlying sensory skills that allow them to isolate just the muscle groups that are necessary. So they can't just use their hand for writing. They have to use their whole arm and their shoulder and, in effect, their whole body. Here's a little kid with this motor, this postural disorder, always writhing, never comfortable in his chair at school. And, you know, the teachers understood it, and they gave him a lot of squeezes and a lot of playground activity, and you can see from his dungarees that he's certainly been playing outside a lot. And that was useful for him, but still moving all the time. Okay, and another kind of sensory-based motor disorder, this is the last subtype, is dyspraxia. We saw that little boy before who was not dyspraxic at all, the one with his feet in the yellow sand buckets, getting all that wonderful sensory input through his touch system, his proprioception, his vestibular system, his tactile system, his hearing, his seeing. He was totally engrossed. Kids with dyspraxia wouldn't go near those yellow buckets and orange traffic cones. They wouldn't come up with that idea. These are kids who tend to like just what's easy to do. They don't. They prefer the same old, because each new complex action is daunting. Before we were I was talking about putting on a seatbelt in a new car. There's a lot of sensory information we need. We need to use our vestibular system to turn our head to see where the seatbelt's coming from. Then we need vision to locate it. Then we need our proprioceptive sense to extend our arm. Then our tactile sense is involved as we hold on to the gizmo. And then proprioceptive comes in again as we draw the seatbelt across our body. And our auditory sense is involved as we latch the seatbelt. So it's important, and we will be attentive in many of our sensory systems to a job like this. Well, that kind of thing is very hard for a dyspraxic person. And many, many children with autism, of course, are dyspraxic because their sensory systems are not well developed. So what happens is they tend to be clumsy and uncoordinated, and it takes them a long time to do tasks that are simple for other children. One thing we want to do is break the jobs down, and I'm sure many of you are doing that beautifully, where you don't just say, okay, do this 500-piece jigsaw puzzle. No, of course not. We start with something simpler, but then we want to keep adding to it and adding to it. All right. Here we have a little boy. He had high-functioning autism. He was very anxious, and high anxiety is a given. It goes along with sensory processing disorder, because children are not feeling confident about their bodies and what their bodies can do. They know they're clumsy. They feel different, and they would like to be successful and tend to be anxious about it. A common phrase you're going to hear from kids is, I can't do that, even before they have had an opportunity to try it. They'll turn off before they start something, because they're already so down on themselves. So what we want to do is, with our goggles on, find out what's giving them the problem in a sensory way and see if we can ameliorate that problem somehow. Let's look at this little boy. This was a lovely, mild spring day in Washington, D.C. There was no reason for mittens, but this little boy had his mittens or his gloves on, not for warmth, but to protect the sensitive palms of his hands. So he had tactile over responsivity, and we saw that in the classroom all the time. He had no interest in using the tools. He had to be coaxed, and the situation had to be quiet, and he had to feel he had some control over using those fine motor implements. And we did that for him. And anyway, here he is outside, so he's not cold, but he's got the gloves on. He is stuck. He's on a climbing apparatus. It's about 4 feet off the ground. It's part of an obstacle course that his classmates had been enjoying, and he really wanted to do it because kids like obstacle courses, but it was very hard for him. It took him a long, long time to do everything. And he got to this last obstacle, and he is stuck. The term we use is fixed. His knees are fixed together. His ankles are fixed. His shoulders are tight. You can't see it here, but his tongue is out. So there's some overflow there. So his tactile, his proprioceptive, his tactile sense is affecting his behavior. His proprioceptive sense, which is not well developed, is preventing him from being able to use his body freely for extending and flexing his muscles and using both sides of the body together. His vestibular sense is off. He's uncomfortable being off the ground, and he can't go up, he can't go down. All right, fortunately his teacher is here. You can see her profile on the very right edge of the photograph. She knows she can't talk him out of this because you all know this too. When a child is very anxious or is afraid, talking isn't going to help. It's being there that helps. I don't mean don't talk, because soothing words are very comforting, but I mean, this is not a situation where a teacher would win if she gives the child detailed verbal instructions about how to get off that climbing apparatus. So anyway, she says to him, "I'm right here," and she does a technique that I recommend. It's called hand under hand, or in this case it was hand behind knee. She, when you put your hand under a child's hand or behind him, it gives him a psychological sense that he's the one in charge, and that can be very helpful. Instead of facilitating him by putting your hand on top of his, try putting it under. So she did that with him, and she talked to him a little bit. She said, "Now we're going to move this leg here. We're going to put this hand there." And step by step, inch by inch, he got down to the blacktop, pouring buckets of sweat. But he smiled, and he said, I did it. And then he wanted to do it again all by himself. So it was a winning day for that little boy, and he managed to get through that obstacle course a little bit faster each time. But a lot was going on. There are possible coexisting disorders. Wait, let's see. Yes, okay. A bunch of possible coexisting disorders with SPD. Anxiety that we just mentioned. Autism and Asperger's syndrome, definitely. And I've talked to Temple Grandin about the coexistence of SPD and autism, and she believes that 100% of people with autism have sensory issues. You may see that there are other statistics that are not 100%, and it depends on who's talking, I guess. But it's pretty clear that people with autism and Asperger's do have oversensitivity or undersensitivity to sensations. And these other disorders on this list also overlap with SPD, and sometimes the SPD looks like one of these when it isn't. I knew a little boy who had SPD. His mother was a good friend of mine, and she would tell me things like how he washed his hands all the time and how he ran around the dining room table a lot before going out of the house, and how he liked to press his hands and his knees and his hips into the door jams and get a lot of pressure that way. And so then one day she told me that she was telling the pediatrician about this, and he said, "Oh, that sounds like he has obsessive compulsive disorder. Maybe we should consider giving him some anti-anxiety medicine. And she didn't want to do that, so we talked about it, and I said, why don't you just take him to an OT and see if these behaviors are significant enough to warrant some OT. And I thought they were, but, you know, I didn't want to push too much. Anyway, that was correct. This little boy just had SPD. He was not obsessive. He was washing his hands because he did have tactile over-responsivity, and he liked his hands clean. And he ran around the dining room table because he needed to rev up his vestibular system. And he liked to press his body against the door jamb and get that resistance because his proprioceptive system needed more input. So he had over-responsivity, and he had under-responsivity, and OT fixed him up, and everything has turned out well for him. There are some other possible coexisting problems with SPD. Vision and hearing and speech are often coexist. Here's what happens with vision. We are born to move, and we are born to see far out there, and that is what we need to move, and we need to be able to see, and as protective skills, survival skills. So we need to be able to look out at the horizon, see what's coming at us, and make the decision whether we're going to run or go toward that thing or hide or freeze or whatever we're going to do. We've got to have eyes that can see out far and then see close, and see out far and see close rapidly. We are not designed to look at electronic screens. Our eyes are not designed for that, and that's what we're doing more and more and more. Most children today watch, oh, I don't know what the statistic is now, something like 6 hours of screen time a day. Little kids. It's unholy. It's so bad. Because what's happening is with looking at a two-dimensional screen, kids are missing all the opportunities to move their bodies and learn about the world in the more important, natural way. It's really hard to learn about a three-dimensional world through a two-dimensional device like an electronic screen. You've got to get your kids out there moving and doing and participating so that they learn about things like how far away something is or how much time it takes to get ready for that thing. For instance, to swing a bat or catch a frisbee or hug a friend who's walking towards you. So vision is impacted by our society these days, and in kids who have sensitive neurological systems, all of the screen activity is not doing them any favor. Here's something you can do right where you are. Push your hand out away from you, in front of you, with your index finger pointing to the ceiling, and your elbow straight. All right, now bend your elbow and gradually bring your finger towards your nose. And as you do, I want you to hang on to your finger with your eyes. Now your eyes will cross. All right, now you're there. Now push your finger away again. And do this a few times. This is called convergence when your finger comes towards your nose, and it's called divergence when your finger goes out there. We should be able to do this smoothly. It should not hurt. And we should be able to hang on to one picture of our finger. But a lot of kids, you try that with them, and their eyes cannot hang on to that one finger. Their eyes don't cross. Or maybe their eyes do cross, but at the wrong time. Another thing kids are having trouble doing is tracking. That means being able to hold their bodies and heads still and let their eyes go back and forth from side to side as they would if they were watching a ping pong match. Convergence and tracking are pretty important skills for reading, for doing work at school, for seeing the blackboard and then looking at your desk, for watching a ball on the playground and determining what you're supposed to do with it. You know, we need to have that rapid back and forth ability and visual problems can arise if the underlying touch and movement sensations are not working well. Same thing, or similar story with hearing. If we are having our kids do a lot of sitting, which they're doing, and having them listen to what's coming out of the TV or the video game, they're getting, or worse, through earbuds in their ears, they're not learning the huge variety of sounds that there are in the world. They're not getting sharpened skills on locating where sounds come from. So remember I was saying before about the over-responsive child who startles when the door slams and he jumps up and he looks all around? Many kids with SPD have difficulty locating where sound comes from. So wouldn't you be scared and uncomfortable, too, if you didn't know where that sound was coming from? And when the teacher calls your name and you don't know where it's coming from and you're looking all around, wouldn't you feel lost? And I think that's something that happens quite a bit. Hearing the whole world helps you differentiate and discriminate sounds. What's a friendly sound? What's a hostile sound? What's the sound of a human voice and versus a barking dog and a vacuum cleaner versus a truck going down the street? The more sounds we hear, the more adept we become at differentiating the parts of speech. So that we can establish a good sense of grammar and syntax, and we can develop a vocabulary and use all the rich sounds that we hear to formulate sentences and speak. And then as we get older, we can use our good sensory underpinnings for writing, too. So vision and hearing and speech are big issues that can also be affected by the underlying sensory, vestibular, and proprioceptive problems that prevent children from gaining the sensory motor experiences they need. Sleeping and eating are big issues. Many children with SPD are erratic sleepers. In my book, The Out of Sync Child, I have some suggestions, including no TV time, no electronics for at least 2 hours before bedtime. And I know that's really hard for a lot of families, but it's a suggestion worth trying. Watch the child's diet carefully. No additives or sugar before bedtime, or in fact, during the day. Then there are supplements that you can give that would help children with their sleeping. A good idea is a nice warm bath just before bed, right into pajamas and right into bed. And that doesn't mean that sleep has to be right away. There can be some games or some reading or storytelling at bedtime. But right from bath into bed is a good way to get the child ready for sleep. So there are other things that can be done as well. And therapists can help with that in many cases. Eating is a huge issue, huge. And let's look at why eating should be a problem. Well, tactile over-responsivity means that things that are strange are not going to be welcomed in the mouth. So some children just want a very smooth diet. Everything has to be creamy and like yogurt and milk and maybe grilled cheese sandwiches, but the crust on the bread has to be off. And pasta would be acceptable, but not a carrot. Heavens no. Not an apple. Nothing crunchy. Then there are kids who like only the crunchy, and they will want crackers and pretzels. And I knew this little boy who only ate carrots, pretzels, and crispy bacon. And his parents knew this was a problem, but they wanted to have regular mealtime, and so they would make him these three items or provide them for him so he would come to the table. And they had other children in the family, and this dinner time was important, so I thought that was a good idea. Then he came to nursery school and would have a meltdown if at snack time it was not carrots or pretzels. And, of course, there was never the option of crispy bacon at nursery school. But if the teacher brought out an oatmeal cookie, he would have a meltdown. Or applesauce, he would have a meltdown. Or if they baked zucchini bread, which was a thrilling experience for many kids to do the cooking, he wouldn't go near the cooking either, and he hated the taste and the smell and everything about zucchini bread. What to do with this child? Well, it turned out that we screened him and found that he really had a lot of evidence of sensory processing and suggested occupational therapy for the parents. So they did get OT for him. They were a little apprehensive because they didn't know what it was, but they were fast learners and were just thrilled with the outcome. A few weeks after he had started OT, he was having two or maybe three sessions a week with an OT in her clinic. And then at home, the parents had implemented a sensory diet, which were activities that the OT suggested that included arousing, organizing, and calming activities for him. So he was doing the sensory diet at school, and the teachers at school were working to make things better for him. And one day, he came to school late, and the story was that he had just started to enjoy playing in the mud outside, and it was a very muddy season, and there was mud in the sandbox. And he now, with OT, was beginning to be more comfortable with messy play. And he liked it, and he was getting more social. This is like after 3 weeks of OT. So one day he was late, and when he finally came, the mother came up to me, and she said, "Oh, the most exciting thing happened today. My son couldn't find his boots, and he likes to wear his boots like the other kids do because outside it's so muddy, and we're so happy that he's in the mud. It's just wonderful. He couldn't find his boots, and he knew that his little brother had hidden them. So my son took his little brother's arm in his hands, and he bit it, and it was the first soft thing he ever put in his mouth." So we all got a good laugh out of that. Fortunately, he did not break the skin of his little brother's arm, but it was the first soft thing he put in his mouth. He only ate crunchy things. And OT for this little boy turned him around. He's now an adult. He's almost 30 years old. He's doing beautifully. He eats all kinds of things. And I saw his mom recently, and she said, "You know, when he was little, we despaired that he would ever have close friends or a girlfriend because he couldn't tolerate the touch of another person. But I'm happy to tell you that he does have a wonderful girlfriend, and they're going to get married soon." So that was a great story. Well, that was just one little anecdote about eating, and there are many others. Another is a story of a child with autism. And Winnie Dunn, the well-known occupational therapist whose work is the sensory profile, Winnie Dunn was working with a child who only ate French fries, and his mother was frantic, and the doctor said, "Oh, well, he's growing," and the mother thought the doctor could be better than that. But anyway, Winnie Dunn and the mom decided to figure out what was okay about French fries. So they watched him eat, and he would take a French fry and put it right in the center of his tongue and kind of swallow it whole. And they decided that probably he just had one special place that was comfortable for him, and anywhere else would not be comfortable. And the texture was right. So they were onto something. They began to julienne other kinds of food, like chicken and turkey, and they started parboiling vegetables so that they were a consistency that didn't require a lot of chewing, and gave this child little sticks of food, and he would take them flats them carefully on the center of his tongue and swallows them. And his diet improved dramatically. He didn't care what it tasted like. It was just what the shape was like. So that was just great, a great use of sensory goggles. Now, kids who don't eat well are also not going to have great digestion. They might be constipated or have diarrhea quite a bit. They might have bladder control problems, and a lot of that is related to what they eat. Also, many, many children with autism and with SPD have inflamed guts, leaky guts, where the bacteria builds up, and they're gassy, they flatulate a lot, they might burp a lot, they might not smell good, they might have bad breath. And these kids are in distress. A lot of it is because the food they eat is not something that they can absorb well. Big culprits seem to be milk and dairy products and wheat. And other children seem to be very sensitive to additives in food. So what you need to do is look at labels, of course, and be careful about getting food that's overprocessed. The best food is fresh food that needs refrigeration. The worst food is food that can stay on the shelf for years and years and years because it's made in a laboratory. It's not real food. All right, let's go on here. See what else we got here. What can we do to help our kids? Well, if you're interested in learning more about sensory processing disorder, I suggest you go to spdfoundation.net. This is the big website. Lucy Jane Miller, whom I mentioned before, is the director of SPD Foundation, and this is the website where you'll see postings of recent research, and there's a registry where you can find some specialists in your area. You can do some e-learning. You can join a support group or start one, and you'll see many other wonderful things at that website. I also am very proud to be the editor-in-chief of this magazine, SI Focus. We're just about to have our first e-magazine. It's been a hard copy up until now, but it's now going to go online, which is greatly reduces the cost of a subscription, and there are many, many benefits to it. So it's a wonderful magazine, if I do say so myself. Kathleen Morris, a speech and language therapist, who also, like me, is an OT wannabe. Kathleen is the publisher. Another way to help is early prevention. And with kids with autism, what we want to do as soon as possible is get them on a nutritious diet that is going to give them real food and not Twinkies, not the things that they like, unfortunately. But we have to find ways to make things that taste good. One thing that I've heard people having success with is it's called the Trojan horse method. Some of you might know more about it than I do, but it's where you chop up or grind up fruits and vegetables and put those as ingredients into things that the child will like. And I know one little boy who refuses all fruits and vegetables, but he likes to cook. He likes that messy play, and his mom encourages him to stand on a stool at the counter, and they mix beets and she uses beets and zucchini and carrots, and she grinds them up and gets them really small, and he mushes them into the muffin dough, and then he will eat the muffins. So he's getting the nutrients from the fruits and vegetables, and he knows that they're in there. Of course, don't put a beet on his plate. He would never look at it, but there are ways to sneak food into a child's diet if necessary. And if you're desperate, and if you feel your pediatrician is not as concerned as you want him to be, then I would suggest looking for a nutritionist who understands the whole development of the child, and this, a nutritionist who really understands sensory processing. She will be able to say, oh, it's tactile issues that are preventing your child from eating, or, oh, it's proprioceptive problems. He doesn't know where the food is in his mouth. He doesn't have the stamina to chew, which is a proprioceptive function. It could be the smell is something that the child is offended by. Even vision can interfere with the child's enjoyment of food. If, for instance, he doesn't like the way the juice from the hamburger sloshes over toward the french fries, he might be very uncomfortable that way. All kinds of sensory things can affect the way a child eats. So a nutritious diet is important to find one that the child will eat comfortably. Sensory motor and perceptual motor experiences, of course, are very important. Sensory motor would be activities that bring in the touch, the movement, the visual, the auditory information in a way that the child can not only tolerate but also benefit from. Perceptual motor experiences, these are built on sensory experiences. Perceptual motor experiences are moving in a diagonal or rolling down the hill or, I just wrote a book about it with Joy Newman, who was a perceptual motor therapist, and here I am stumbling. If you want to see a book about it, the book is Growing an Instinct Child. And there are tons of ideas in there of perceptual motor activities to help kids get the skills they need. And, of course, we want quality child care and education, which is so much better early than later. If a difficulty is getting in the child's way, I mean, if you see your child is avoiding activities that other child finds pleasant, let's say finger painting, or is resisting letting his feet leave the ground, like swinging, then don't wait about getting therapy. Go right ahead. The sooner the better, because while children's brains are still plastic, therapy can help very much and help the child develop the skills he needs so he won't need later intervention. So here are some therapies that I recommend. OTSI, this is occupational therapy using sensory integration techniques. And that is the best kind of experience for kids with SPD. And most children, 99.99999% of children getting OT love it, because the experienced occupational therapist will follow the child's inner drive and will help the child master the skills that he really wants to master. If the child is getting OT and is not enjoying it, maybe it's time to think about another therapist. Or maybe that OT does not know very much about sensory processing and sensory, also called sensory integration. And so maybe the techniques she's using are useful but not really getting to the core of what the child needs. Physical therapy using SI is helpful too, PTSI. Speech and language therapy that uses sensory integration techniques is very beneficial. Vision therapy, I love vision therapy, also called visual training. This is provided by a behavioral optometrist or a developmental optometrist who is an eye doctor whose concern is with the behavior of the eyes. As opposed to an ophthalmologist whose interest is the health of the eyes. And so many kids, tons of kids, have visual problems because their eyes are not functioning together as a team. And the behavioral therapist will play games with the child that will strengthen the way the two eyes work together. It can be fabulously beneficial. Auditory therapy, that's therapy like the listening program where the child typically is wearing big, cushy, comfortable earphones and listening to, often it's classical music like Mozart or Bach, and sometimes at the same time the child is balancing on a teeter-totter and throwing beanbags into a bucket and doing some perceptual tasks at the same time that he's getting this, the music pumped into his ears in a way that's calibrated just for him. So those are some activities and nutritional therapy we talked about too. Here's some other websites. These don't show up very well, but sensoryworld.com and my two websites might be helpful. And DevDelay, that stands for Developmental Delay Resources.org, which has a lot of very good information. Now, Dr. Ayers said that fun is the child's word for SI. And so the more we can provide for these kids where they're going to get real fun, where they're doing, they are in charge. They are coming up with what they're going to do with the objects around them. They're making up the rules. That is so beneficial for kids. And if they don't already do that, encourage them to do it. I like to use things like cardboard tubes from paper towels and an 8-inch section of rope from laundry rope and a few strings and a few stretchy bands like TheraBands and just have things around like that and have them handy. And kids will look at them and they'll say, what do you do with it? Because they're waiting for the on-off button. And if you say, I don't know what you can do with it, you show me. You will see some pretty magical things happening. Another thing I want you to remember is that the more important an activity is, the more sensations we use. I referred to that a little bit when we were talking about getting into a new car seat, a seat belt. The more important an activity is, the more sensations, more senses we use so that we'll get it, we'll understand it, we'll master it. And there are two human activities that use all sensations simultaneously. One of them is eating, and the other is procreating. So if you can come up with any more, you let me know. Other than those two, since we're not doing those all the time, we want activities that use a lot of input. And here's some suggestions on this slide. In natural settings, such as the playground, the backyard, the kitchen, the bathroom, that's where we can offer kids things that they can do what they want with. In the bathtub, you can have sponges and different textured cloths and different things to pour with and squeeze and all kinds of things you can find around the house that don't require a big expenditure. Try them in the bathtub. Deep pressure. It seems that many kids can't get enough of that. And I think we should give our kids many, many hugs a day. I have an OT friend who says everybody needs 12 bear hugs a day for good mental health. And especially when your child is behaving in a way where what you'd like to do is walk out the door and get in the car and leave, that's when you need to go toward your child and give her a hug. We also need to provide heavy work activities. And we don't do that anymore. We don't have so many heavy work activities in our lives these days. We have snow blowers and leaf blowers instead of rakes and shovels. We have remote controls, so we don't even have to get out of the chair to go turn off the TV. Let's make our kids go back to the old-fashioned thing called movement. And that leads me to the last bullet here, which is swing, pump, jump, tumble, climb, stretch, run, dig, crawl, and slide as much as possible. Okay, so tomorrow when it's dinner time, instead of saying come to the table, why don't you try jump to the table or slither to the table or, you know, make a game, a different way to go upstairs for bed. Especially if a child doesn't want to go to bed, you can say, tonight you get to choose which way you're going to go up. You're going to go up sideways or backwards. give a child a choice, he has then some control, and it's it might be just the ticket instead of you're saying it's time for bed and having him say no. Here's our last slide. This is a little boy carrying a big bag of mulch. And what I want us all to do is keep our sensory goggles on, think positively about our children, think about all the things they can do, think about their deep interest and deep knowledge in their favorite subjects, and why not go with that? You know, if it's trains or planets or vacuum cleaners, or why not figure out a way to stretch that somehow, because that in-depth curiosity leads to in-depth learning and knowledge. And I want us all to think that we've got to get our kids moving. Every child has a movement quota. You do too. Every one of you listening has a movement quota. And you know, if you've been at your desk too long, how you're restless when you're trying to sleep, or you're cranky. I know it's true for me, and it's especially true for our children. So that's a drop in the bucket about sensory processing. Thank you for listening, and I'm going to have a little sip of water, and you can ask questions now.
Carol, that was just wonderful. I wonder if you could go back and put up the slide with your website on it, Out of Sync Child website, because you have links from that website to all these other resources that you've listed there as well. You actually have a link to the spdfoundation.net and sensory resources, specialneeds.com, all of those.
Yeah, good.
All of those wonderful links.
Thank you. So it's outofsyncchild.com, and I would welcome people to come visit.
It's just a plethora of information, I have to say. All your listed resources, you have OT, PT, all the auditory and therapy training, Brain Gym. You list chiropractic, and I wondered if you know much about interactive metronome.
I have had one day of a session with it, and that's the extent of it. And of course, I want to remind everyone that I'm not a therapist myself, so I don't ever do it. And I liked it. I liked it. It's based on the idea that a lot of us are many people, and especially kids with sensory issues, don't have good rhythm. And you know, we need rhythm when we walk, when we talk. We need to have what's called rhythmicity, and interactive metronome helps kids learn to find that rhythm, which is not natural. So I like it. I have found more people like the listening program, and that's the most popular with therapists and with families. And then there's another one that I'm very interested in called Integrated Listening Systems, ILS. And that they're rather new, ILS, and they guarantee success, which I think is bold. So they must know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very nice. And you mentioned brushing and the tea stool both in your presentation there. I wondered if you might know where folks might look for these items.
Well, the brushing should not be something that a parent does independently. Mm-hmm. It really needs to be done with an occupational therapist guiding it. So anybody could go online and learn about it, but then they have to hook up with an OT.
Uh-huh.
Now, that is not to say that we can't use brushes and offer the brushes to the kids. Like you could take, I have a brush that I got at the grocery store. It's for brushing corn silk off a cob. which I think is ridiculous because I think children should be picking that off themselves. But anyway, it's a soft, plasticky kind of bristle. Now, we can give brushes like that to kids and let them do what they want with it, or maybe we could even brush their arms and legs a little bit, but we wouldn't call it the Wheelbarger protocol, and I just want to be cautious.
Sure.
Yeah.
And the how to hug.
Oh, the how to hug. Oh, yeah. Oh, and the tea stool you mentioned. The how to hug, that's howtohug.com, howdahug, how to hug. And those are just lovely. And the tea stool, I think if parents go to TheraPro, TheraPro, TheraPro.com, I think that they'll see some choices there. Or they could also Google tea stools. I have made tea stools myself, so I don't buy them. They're so easy to make. You get two pieces of a 2x4, and each piece is about 12 inches, and you can be approximate in your measurements. And you just take wood screws and screw one onto the end of the other. I have directions for it in my books, The Out of Sync Child and The Out of Sync Child Has Fun. And what you want to do is make this little stool so that when the child sits on it, his ankles and feet are at right angles. So, in other words, an average height for a four-year-old would be 14 inches off the ground. An average height for a three-year-old would be 12 inches off the ground. But, you know, it varies, of course. So, I love the cheap stuff, Nancy. As a former teacher, I learned about beautiful junk, and I never look at a wrapping paper tube without thinking, "Oh, how can we use this?" So that's the kind of thing that I like to do with little kids.
That's what I like about both of your Out of Sync Child book and your Out of Sync Child Has Fun book, is that you're using everyday objects in new ways.
Oh, yeah.
Things I would never have thought about. Now, is that carried on through your other books and Growing an NSYNC Child as well?
Definitely. I think the most expensive thing we suggest in Growing an NSYNC Child is a flashlight. And the other materials are stuff you just pick up around the house. And Growing an NSYNC Child, Joy Newman, who is a perceptual motor therapist, has a company here in town called Kids Moving Company, and she works with a lot of kids with autism and motor coordination problems. And they do obstacle courses, and they jump over string, and they poke their finger through a hole that one of her activities is taking a pipe cleaner and making a circle out of it and then having the child stick his finger right into the center of the hole. I mean, this is not high tech. But that one, for instance, where you're poking your finger through the hole made by a pipe cleaner, that's visual motor. It's vestibular because you have to be steady and balanced while you do it. It's proprioceptive because you're stretching. I mean, it's tactile. There's so much going on. It's great. And the kid's moving. Joy has treated many kids with autism. And as a teacher, I taught at a school that included 10% of the population at the school where kids with identified special needs. So we got all kinds of kids with special needs. And then there were many children who did not have diagnoses but came to our school knowing that it took kids where they were and loved them and honored them and let them play their hearts out. So we were outside all the time, at least 90 minutes out of every 3-hour program. So the school attracted children with some developmental delays because it was what these kids needed and thrived in. And so I find once you give me a question, Nancy, what I'm trying to get at is that Joy and I have experience working with kids with special needs, and so many of them are doing well. It is the kids who are not diagnosed that we're concerned about these days. We think we are at a critical juncture in our raising up children these days. We are giving them the wrong tools. And so our book, Growing an Instinct Child, is really designed to grab the attention of the parents of typical children, to say, get them away from the TV and the flashcards and give them a ball and a road made out of masking tape.
Mm-hmm. Now, are diagnoses or assessments done typically by OTs?
Yes. This is the way it works, that the OT does the assessment, and then she says to the pediatrician, I say that Jimmy has SPD, and then the doctor gives the diagnosis. And it's really unfair, and it might change, and it is changing in some states, but mostly it's the doctor who gives the diagnosis, even though he depends on the OT to come to that conclusion. Many doctors do not understand SPD, and it's not their fault. There isn't time for learning about it in medical school, and it's not a disease, and there is no medicine for it. You can't cure it. So you can help it, and you can ameliorate it, and you can make huge, permanent, fabulous changes in the brain with OT that will make a huge difference for kids with SPD, but there's no medicine. And here's the sad thing. Because there's no medicine, because activity and kind of a lifestyle is what helps kids with SPD, because there's no medicine, drug companies are not supporting research. So the money for research comes from private sources. It comes from family foundations. It comes from you and me. And it's not in the DSM yet, because there hasn't been sufficient research, according to the DSM writers.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't research because there isn't money to pay for it. And there isn't money to pay for it because it isn't in the DSM. So it's like this
mm-hmm.
circle.
Right.
But it might get into the DSM-5. We're pretty hopeful. Mm-hmm. And then there will be more recognition. And what's so crazy, you know, there's no controversy about sensory processing. Everybody will accept the fact that there's sensory processing. And everybody can understand when some people don't process sensations easily. The controversy is what helps, and that's because it's so hard to say that OT has cleared up SPD the way, you know, penicillin can clear up strep throat. We see significant differences that OT makes, and children are better, and parents are better, and families are better, and Lucy Miller and her colleagues are doing research that they've done a longitudinal study, a 10-year study, taking different groups of children and giving some OT for several weeks, and then just playing for several weeks, and you know, there's a variety of different ways they treat these children, and then they study the children's responses to given tasks, and the ones who get the OT show very good improvement. But it's really hard and time-consuming to do that kind of research to show the benefits, even though we know they're there.
So I'm understanding you to say that while there could be significant improvement, there's no known instant cure.
So, you know, if a child has significant SPD as a child and gets recognized and gets treated, chances are good that those sensory issues will greatly diminish and the child will turn into a functioning adult. If those sensory needs are not addressed, the child does not grow out of them. He grows into them and becomes more reclusive or more sensory-seeking or more clumsy. You know, with our goggles on, we can really make a difference when we see kids. And Nancy, I want to tell you one more story. I was very interested in screening kids for this, and I worked with a wonderful occupational therapist named Lynn Balzer-Martin, who taught me a lot about this back in the 80s and 90s. And we would screen kids, and then we would talk to their parents and say, gee, it looks like your child really is uncomfortable on the playground, and we suggest maybe getting some therapy or let's work together, school and home together, to collaborate to see how we can make this child be more comfortable and more of a participant. And then a week or so later, we would begin to see this incredible improvement in the child whose parents we had just talked to. And we teachers would say, are they getting OT so soon? Did that OT have room for them to get started so soon? Well, no. The parents were in line to get OT, but in the week, they had started taking the kid out more to the playground and giving the child more tasks to do around the house and spending more time at the swing and sifting flour and pushing boxes across the kitchen floor and, you know, carrying bottle babies around. And there was just the consciousness of the parents was raised in making the child more active.
Uh-huh.
And we began to see dramatic differences in the child. So that was
so exciting.
It really
that we
is.
Could do something just that simple.
Yes. Yes. Now, wait, but I want to qualify. I mean, there are kids. I don't want everyone to get excited and say, okay, we're going to go make some bottle babies and everything will be fine. It's not that simple. But we can never hurt our children by making them active participants. And if it's taking away sensory overload that makes the child participate more, then take away the overload. If it's providing more sensation, then provide it. I love it when people buy my books, but I don't mean to be a saleswoman about it. I just want to say that if you go to the library and take out The Out of Sync Child and look at some of the characteristics that are in the book and, you know, make a Xerox of it, of the list, and then check off the ones that describe your child, that can be very helpful in showing you patterns. When I started learning about this, I didn't understand why the child who only ate saltines for snack and would not take his shoes off on barefoot day and could not stand in line without slugging the kids around him and complained about the tags in his T-shirts, I didn't understand what was going on until I saw that this was a pattern of tactile over-responsivity.
Mm-hmm.
I wish it were as clear as chicken pox. You know, you see what you see is what you get.
Hey, you got to put on those sensory goggles.
You do.
That's for sure. That's for sure. Well, We're running low on time, but I did want to give the opportunity for our callers to ask a question or two before we sign off tonight. And it's obvious that we're going to have you back.
Oh, thank you.
Just for 2 hours of Q&A, because there's no way we can fit all this into just 2 hours. So we'll have to have you back for sure.
I would,
but you would be
glad to come back.
Sensory silly. We want to let our callers know that if you would like to ask a question, please press star 2 to raise your hand, and we will take your calls. Like I said, we are running low on time, but I have been addressing our Internet questions as we went along and asked them as bundled questions because they are so very similar. One of them is being repeated over and over to Carol is, can kids fall under more than one category as far as the categories of sensory issues?
Oh, good question. Excellent question. Yes, indeed. And it can be bewildering when you put your goggles on and you say, but wait a minute, he's touching everything, yet you say he's over-responsive to touch. Or there can be a lot of confusion. There can be a combination of issues that beset a child. A common combination is tactile over-responsivity, where the child does not want passive touch. He'll shriek and jump if you surprise him with a touch. Light, unexpected touch, like someone just giving an affectionate little stroke on the child's head, or having to wear a hat, or having a raindrop drop on his head. That might be really, really terrifying to a child who has over-responsivity. And food, eating food is a big problem, and socializing, and clothing, and being touched and not being in control can be very scary. At the same time, that child might be touching everything because he's the active toucher. He's not the touchy, he's the toucher. And so he's going to have his special blanket, and he's going to have a special teddy bear, and he's going to walk around with a plastic scoop in his hand all the time, and he's going to have things that bring him comfort. Or he might be exploring things, wanting to touch a lot because he's craving tactile information but just can't stand being touched.
Mm-hmm.
That kid can also be the child who craves movement. We see a lot of that. Tactile over-responsivity. Don't come near me, but give me that swing. And that could be the same child.
I see my son falling in a couple of different categories.
Yeah, and it can change. It can vary with time and circumstance. It can be dependent on how much sleep the child has had, or what he has eaten, or what kind of activity he has had, or especially what kind of activity he has not had. And let's always think that our children never get enough activity. I really, that's a pretty blanket statement, but kids need a lot more activity and a lot less sedentary stuff.
Even the kids that are bouncing off the walls?
Yes. Yes, they do. They do. They need it structured. But their behavior is saying they need movement. Now, the kids who are bouncing off the wall, you can give them more deep pressure and more heavy work activity, and that might be helpful because what they're looking for is input into their muscles and joints, or give them resistive things to do like TheraBands to stretch, or Nancy, you came to a conference I did. Did I have a bicycle inner tube? Did you see?
Yes.
Yeah, that's one of my really, really cheapo toys. You go to the trash bin at the bicycle store and pull out the old bike tubes and let a couple of kids inside tug and pull each other out on the grass. That's a lot of fun. But I don't feel like I finished that first question. There can be a child can be affected in all sensory domains, or in one or two, or one on Monday and another one on Thursday. So there can be a lot of back and forth. But commonly we see the over-responsive to tactile sensation kid. We see the same kid under-responsive to movement, so he needs more or he's seeking.
Mm-hmm.
And often that child also has auditory processing difficulty.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we must have done a really good job either of answering folks' questions, or they're just going to hold them until the next time we have
them,
because no one has their hand raised.
Okay.
But that's okay, because we are out of time. It's been such a delight to talk with you, Carol,
Thank
and your
you.
Presentation is always...